This program contains graphic content and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised. A beautiful young bride-to-be vanishes while jogging just days before her trip down the aisle.
Clearly, a serious crime had been committed.
Her disappearance spawns nationwide news headlines, an exhaustive search, and suspicions of murder.
I just remember the buzz in the newsroom. Could it be the fiancé?
But a late-night phone call changes everything.
I was kidnapped from Atlanta, Georgia.
She turns up alive after reportedly being kidnapped and raped by two captors.
Please don't.
Everybody wanted to know what had happened to this poor girl.
Then, the twist no one expects.
As the story started to unfold, there was just so many inconsistencies in her story.
Was she really abducted? Or will the truth prove to be stranger than fiction?
When the truth came out, they were confused, and then they got pissed.
Our newsroom just went berserk.
Meet Jennifer Wilbanks, a.k.a. the Runaway Bride. A pretty young Southern belle with big wedding plans. Until scandal made her famous. When Jennifer Wilbanks disappeared a few days before her wedding, reporters from local and national news outlets descended upon her Atlanta suburb. Developing details about the missing person case were broadcast around the clock.
It was around the time where a lot of women were starting to become missing. We had just came off the heels of Lacey Peterson and the whole Scott Peterson case. And we were nervous. Everyone was nervous saying, not again, not another one.
It just became the story that everybody was talking about.
The relentless coverage only increased when Wilbanks was found. Shock and surprise followed when the truth behind her three-day absence was revealed.
This story was huge. People magazine had 11 reporters working on this story. 11. And we put it on our cover because everybody was talking about Jennifer Wilbanks.
But what really happened to Jennifer Wilbanks? And why did she garner a nickname that was the title of a Julia Roberts movie?
She grew up in the town of Gainesville, which is north of Atlanta. It's a fairly good-sized town.
Jennifer and her twin brother Matthew grow up in a well-known family with deep roots in their community.
She came from a family that was obviously, you know, very involved in the community where she lived.
Her parents split when she was just 6 years old, but for the most part, things were pretty friendly.
All right, guys. Here's how it's going to be going forward, okay? You're going to spend 1 week with your mom, and you'll spend the next week with me, okay?
Okay, Dad. Okay, Dad.
Jennifer splits her time between her parents, and church is an important part of her childhood.
Jennifer said that she had a great life, that she grew up in an honest home, and that faith was very important to her.
In high school, Wilbanks is an honor student and a varsity athlete. Running is her strong suit.
She grew up running track. She was described as being really friendly and outgoing.
The 1991 high school graduate heads to the University of Georgia to study pre-med. Her friends describe her as a social butterfly.
But Jennifer became overwhelmed with college life, and she left after just 2 years.
Wilbanks returns home and finds a job in the maternity ward of a medical center.
Adorable, aren't they?
It's like I always tell people, better check my bag before I leave, make sure I don't take any of these little angels home with me.
You have any at home?
Kids? No. Well, my friends do say I'll be the first to get married and have kids. Yeah, someday.
Jennifer was a traditional girl who looked forward to getting married. And in the mid-90s, she was engaged for a short time.
Jennifer Wilbanks appears almost perfect on the outside, but signs of trouble soon emerge.
She didn't have a perfect past. She had had a couple of arrests for shoplifting at a Walmart and at a department store where she worked, and she had apparently let some of her friends take things from the department store.
Between 1996 and 1998, Jennifer is arrested, twice for shoplifting and once for theft.
of all things, one of the things that she stole, a bridal magazine.
Though Jennifer completes a counseling program for one offense, she spends several weekends in jail for another in 1998.
She later said it was kind of a sign of some of the things that she had struggled with her whole life, and she indicated she had struggled with suicidal thoughts and not feeling like she measured up.
In the early 2000s, things seemed to be on track for Jennifer. The shoplifting was behind her, and she was an avid runner who even competed in the Chicago Marathon.
In the fall of 2003, Jennifer Wilbanks meets her Mr. Right. John Mason lives up the road in Duluth, Georgia. Like Jennifer, he enjoys a suburban upbringing in a church-minded community where his father is a prominent political leader.
Everybody knows everybody, and so John's family was very entrenched.
His grandfather had founded this Mason Clinics and had helped found this local hospital and was really well known in the community, and so he was helping manage that clinic.
So you're a runner, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you?
No. But my niece Jennifer is. Maybe you'd like to go running with her sometime.
Jennifer's matchmaking aunt notices that John is a runner just like her niece, and she suggests that they meet.
She's perfect, and I think you two are going to hit it off. And here's her number, right here. Her name's Jennifer. You call her now.
All right. Sure. Okay, sure.
John eventually works up the courage to call Jennifer.
Hello?
Jennifer? Hi, this is John Mason calling. Your Aunt Shirley gave me your phone number.
Oh, God, she's always trying to get me dates. That's so embarrassing.
No, it's okay. So I hear you're into running.
Yeah. Ever since high school. Do you like running, too?
Yeah, for a long time now.
The first time they talked on the phone, it was like instant connection. They talked for 6 hours on the phone, and they talked about everything from University of Georgia football. They were both big sports fans. They were both in the medical field, and they were both Christians, and they were involved in their religious community. So they hit it off, but they had never seen each other. Then I think they talked like every night.
Do you realize we've been talking on the phone for 6 hours?
Then let's have our next conversation in person. How about this weekend?
Okay. But, you know, you might be coming to meet your future wife.
I don't have a problem with that.
They soon meet face to face on their first dinner date.
He told me when she walked in, his first thought was, God is good. So he was happy with her appearance.
Are you into any sports teams?
Well, yes, I'm also into the Falcons. I'm into baseball as well. Go Braves.
They were both big sports fans. She liked sports, and they were both in the medical field, and they were both Christians, and they were involved in their religious community.
Things move quickly for the couple, and just 10 months after meeting, John is ready to take the next step.
While making dinner one night, John gets down on one knee and pulls out a 3-carat solitaire diamond engagement ring.
Jennifer?
Yes?
And he pops the question.
Will you marry me?
Jennifer and John are engaged on August 7th, 2004. And Jennifer moves into John's bachelor pad. But premarital sex is off the table due to John's religious beliefs.
John said later that he was celibate when he met Jennifer. And what's more, he'd never even seen her naked. They were keeping their relationship pure.
They certainly were trying to be chaste in their relationship leading up to their wedding.
They set April 30th, 2005 as their wedding date and plan a posh reception at the Atlanta Athletic Club to follow.
She chose a location that's a very exclusive club. It's members only. And so you know you are well-to-do if you are on that guest list or if you have membership at that venue.
It's clear from the start, theirs will be no ordinary walk down the aisle.
Oh my goodness, it's fantastic.
Wow, this place is huge.
Well, we're gonna need it. Have you seen the current guest list?
Hi, it's nice to see you.
Hi.
You ready for your tour?
Yeah.
Right this way. This banquet space can seat up to 400 people, and then there's an additional side room for your extra 250.
Oh, my gosh.
It's so good.
Look at the view. It's gorgeous.
The wedding that she had planned with her fiance was lavish. It was 28 attendants, 14 groomsmen, and 14 bridesmaids. It was a guest list of 600 people. That's a lot of people to keep happy, to make sure that everything is flowing and all of your T's are crossed and all of your I's are dotted and the flowers are perfect.
Jennifer's wedding is going to be one of the biggest social events that Duluth, Georgia has ever seen.
This is so great.
Let's get it.
Their gift registry was expensive and extravagant, and it had things on it like Lennox china, Waterford crystal, and Wallace silver.
Big weddings are a big deal in the South. Not everybody does it, but it's not at all uncommon.
But that's a lot of pressure for a bride to be under.
John plans a surprise honeymoon, but Jennifer, with the help of a wedding planner, is involved in every other detail, down to the cake knife and flower girl's basket.
I think she got swept up in it. She could have planned something small, but for some reason, that wasn't the route that they took.
Let me get her. Hun, it's Vicky on the phone. She has some questions about the floral arrangements.
Tell her I'll call her back.
Vicky, could she call?
I know that was very stressful, but it sounds like they put it on themselves because, you know, you can have a wedding party at whatever size you want to have it at based upon your stress level and your bandwidth.
Jennifer, it's the caterer.
In the days and weeks leading up to the big event, Jennifer deals with caterers, gown fittings, and the last of her multiple bridal showers.
I'm a little swamped today. How soon do you need an answer?
It can be probably the most stressful time for a Southern girl's life.
Oh, it's so frustrating.
From all appearances, she seemed like she was, I mean, she had obviously tons of friends because of all these bridesmaids, so she seemed like she was, you know, a well-adjusted person, and she was someone who a lot of people cared for in that community.
4 days before the wedding, Jennifer takes the day off of work.
Shortly after 7 p.m., Jennifer heads out to do some shopping at a nearby outdoor mall. She's home in time to greet John when he returns from a run.
Everything seemed normal at home. Jennifer made pork chops for dinner, and they were just talking about their day. Later that evening, Jennifer suits up for a run of her own.
I'm going for my run. I'll be right back, okay?
Okay, be safe.
I will.
Dinner's in the fridge.
She had left her phone at home, all of her identification, so all of that was there, which would have been normal for her going out for a run.
Jennifer heads out into the night at around 8:30 p.m. When Jennifer doesn't return home, John grows concerned.
I believe he was doing some things around the house and time sort of got away from him, and he realized, well, gosh, she sure has gone for a long run. And then at that point, he realized something had to have happened.
Jennifer had been gone for about 2 hours, and now John was getting worried. So he set out to find his fiance.
So he drove around a little bit looking for her, and after that, I believe he started calling friends and relatives saying, hey, Jennifer hadn't come back. Something's got to be wrong.
After calling the hospital, John enlists his parents' help before calling the police. Jennifer has now been gone for approximately 3 hours.
Hi, yes, I would like to report my fiance missing.
John offered up a theory to the police that maybe Jennifer had fainted because she wasn't eating well before the wedding.
By the next morning, Jennifer's still missing, and word of her disappearance is spreading.
I went out that morning, Wednesday morning, and John, her fiance, was there, and his mother was there, and they had been out all night looking for her, so they were both visibly tired, visibly stressed.
Please, God, bring her home.
The story travels like wildfire in her close-knit community.
It was around the time where a lot of women were starting to become missing, and it was another one. It was right here in Atlanta in CNN's own backyard.
Atlanta is a jogger's paradise. Everybody exercises in Atlanta. And so to think that a jogger was missing, you know, just took everybody by surprise. And then to find out she was engaged to be married in a few days, it's like, wow, this is a big story.
Missing person flyers go up around town and circulate to the media.
But those eyes, everybody remembers those striking eyes of hers. You know, she looked very alert, and it just was a little bit scary to think that somebody could be abducted.
Police and volunteers waste no time mounting an intensive search looking for any trace of Jennifer.
Well, there were probably several hundred folks that were involved in the ground search for Jennifer. The area covered was fairly large, several square miles around Duluth, her known running track down toward the Chattahoochee River.
Everyone in the Duluth community, everybody was upset, was out searching, was helping, trying to figure out what could have happened to her, retracing her final steps.
Local police leave no stone unturned.
Law enforcement was dealing with a lot of tips, including one guy who called in and said he'd killed Jennifer Wilbanks and put her body in a dumpster.
And we also started hearing details about the wedding itself and how big it was going to be. And this was a huge wedding, so it sort of started to creep into your mind, what if she just got the jitters? What if she was just going to bail on the whole thing?
Family and friends insist the bride-to-be did not seem to be experiencing any symptoms of cold feet leading up to her walk down the aisle.
But if you know Jennifer, that's not what happened. She was so excited about this wedding.
Jennifer's family and friends were very adamant that she would never do something like just run off, that something had to have happened to her. I met lots of her girlfriends who were out there handing out flyers, and they were just so upset and so worried about poor Jennifer. Where was Jennifer? Nobody could figure it out, how she could just disappear into thin air like that.
She wouldn't do this, so something is wrong.
For 2 days, search teams use everything at their disposal to find the missing brunette.
They had brought in some bloodhounds and I think other tracking dogs on other days, and they had used a helicopter.
Investigators used Jennifer's wedding dress to give canine units something to go on.
They used her wedding dress because she had recently tried it on, and so they let the search dog sniff the wedding dress to get a scent.
Police question family and friends about past boyfriends, but those, too, are dead ends.
At that point, they even questioned registered sex offenders in the neighborhood.
Then, 2 days into the search, investigators find their only real clue.
Did you find anything?
In an area near where her house was that she shared with John Mason, her fiancé, the search led to a clump of hair that was on the edge of this business park.
What's that? It's like human hair. It's called crime scene.
At the time, they cannot conclusively link the hair to the missing bride-to-be.
Well, at that point, when you haven't found her, you think the worst, that something really bad has happened to her and, you know, she possibly was dead.
This is Officer Colburn reporting. We found some human hair down here at the office park. Have crime scene en route.
So then you start to worry, did they drag her by the ponytail, you know? I mean, all this stuff goes through your mind.
And the national media descends on the city of Duluth, waiting for the next development.
Police call off the intensive ground search with no leads. Her desperate family offers a $100,000 reward.
They love Jennifer Wilbanks, and they wanted to find her by any means necessary. And when they put that $100,000 reward out, we knew that they were serious.
However, her fiancé, John Mason, is increasingly becoming a potential suspect in the eyes of the authorities and the public.
I think it wasn't until, you know, a little more time was going by that more eyes started turning to John, because there had been recently the Scott and Lacey Peterson case where it turned out Scott Peterson had killed his wife, and people were thinking, could he be faking it? Could he have had something to do with her being missing?
Mr. Mason, I'm with the FBI. I need to ask you a few questions.
Yes, of course.
The Georgia Bureau of Investigation, FBI, and Duluth PD all conduct searches of John's house, which lasts 3 hours.
In this country, you're innocent until proven guilty. But behind the scenes, we just knew that John had something to do with it. We were looking at him, and we just knew.
Police seize one laptop and two desktop computers from the couple's home. Police also search Jennifer's car.
And they find this owner's manual that has a partial fingerprint that might have blood on it.
And people were looking at her fiancé, looking at John with a side eye, saying, let's get him a polygraph test. Let's find out what he knows.
John agrees to take a private polygraph test.
Did you have anything to do with the disappearance of your fiancé, Jennifer Wilbanks?
No.
When did you notice her missing?
3 hours after she went for a run.
His computer seized, his house searched, the scrutiny, the polygraph test. It was a lot.
I can only imagine what he was going through. I'm sure that the police asked, you know, did they have trouble in their marriage, in their relationship?
John claimed to have no involvement in Jennifer's disappearance, and he even passed a privately administered polygraph test.
Investigators aren't done with John, however, and they return to question him late Friday afternoon.
I was very kind to him. I mean, we didn't treat him as if he was a suspect. The interview was done only for background information, but certainly in the back of everybody's mind, he was always a person of interest. And I think that would be true in any case like this until you develop other leads.
Then, around 1:30 a.m. local time on Saturday, April 30th, John gets the call he's been waiting for, and police listen in.
Hello?
John?
Danny, where are you?
I don't know.
Jennifer, who nobody's heard from for 3 days, is on the line.
Miss Wilbanks, this is Police Chief Randy Belcher. Can you give us any information about what happened to you?
Kidnapped.
You were kidnapped. Did you get a look at your kidnappers?
It was a Hispanic man and a Caucasian woman.
Okay. What type of vehicle were you in?
They drove a blue van.
A van? A panel van? Did it have windows?
I don't know.
She told her fiancé and the police that this couple, a Hispanic man and a white woman, abducted her and forced her into a blue conversion van and drove her around for 3 days.
She also claims that the kidnappers had been after money, but she told them that she and her family didn't have any.
Okay, can you tell us anything about where you are?
I'm in a payphone across from a 7-Eleven.
Okay, good. Does that payphone have a telephone book with it?
Yeah, there's one hanging here.
Okay, there should be a city code on there. Can you tell us what city you're at?
ALB?
ALB Albuquerque?
Ms. Wilbanks, does it look like it could be Albuquerque?
It takes about 15 minutes into the call to realize that she's in Albuquerque, New Mexico, more than halfway across the country. They're not going to get to her soon.
Where's John? Can I talk to John?
He's right here.
Baby, I'm right here. I'm right here. Are you okay?
Get me.
I'm coming to get you right now.
Police and John advise Jennifer to immediately call Albuquerque 911.
Jennifer Wilbanks sounds frantic, confused, and really distressed.
What happened? I was kidnapped from Atlanta, Georgia. And the person that did this to you, was he or she? It was an Hispanic man and a Caucasian woman.
Responding officers rush to her location and find a visibly distraught Jennifer.
They're here.
She also looks different. Her hair is shorter than it was on the missing poster.
Officers begin canvassing the area for signs of the van while Jennifer is escorted to a police substation.
Ma'am, are you safe?
The officer that called me, or the sergeant that called me, said, "You're not going to believe who we have in the back of our police car." And I was like, "Who?" Then they said, "The girl from Georgia." And I knew immediately who she was. It had been all over the news.
Police detectives and FBI agents ask Jennifer to start from the beginning.
I went for my nightly jog.
She initially told them that she had been taken by force, essentially, in Georgia, that she was out running and that she had been abducted.
That's when the story got darker. At some point, she tells officers that she was not only kidnapped, but sexually assaulted as well.
Please don't. Please don't.
She was forced to perform sexual acts on both parties.
Jennifer is able to provide detailed descriptions of her captors to the investigators.
She had actually a pretty good description of them. The female, white female, heavy set. She claimed that the male was Hispanic, rotten teeth.
She then claims they kept her captive on a cross-country trip. She recalls Spanish music playing in the background.
She even described a cooler in the van full of water, beer, and Mountain Dew.
Jennifer also explains that her hair was forcibly cut by her captors.
Jennifer tells police that the woman said to her, "It's your lucky day, darling."
Jennifer says she finally finds her freedom again on the streets of Albuquerque. But as questioning continues over the course of 2 to 3 hours, something about Jennifer's story isn't sitting right with investigators.
So who took your clothes off?
She did.
Did you resist?
Her story really wasn't changing until probably a good hour and a half into the evening.
For these 4 days, you never tried to run or figure out where you were at?
The whole story just didn't hold up, and the FBI was finding a lot of inconsistencies, and they eventually just confronted her.
After hours of questioning, agents are finally able to get the truth from Jennifer.
You know what, Jennifer? I think something did happen to you, but it wasn't a kidnapping. I think it was you saying you couldn't go through with the wedding on Saturday. We can stop looking for that blue van now, right?
Yeah, she lied.
Jennifer finally comes clean and admits that she made up the whole sordid tale.
I cracked under the pressure. I couldn't have the perfect wedding that everyone and me thought I should have.
She made up the story because of the stress. Instead of just saying, "I need some extra time, I need to think about it, or I need to postpone the wedding."
I understand, but how did you come up with this kidnapping rape story?
Seen too many cops and robbers movies, I guess.
Jennifer, why don't you tell us what really happened? It's okay.
It's like I said, I went for my nightly jog.
4 days before her wedding, on the night of Tuesday, April 26th, an anxiety-ridden Jennifer ostensibly goes for a run.
Dinner's in the fridge.
In reality, she had gone out with just the clothes on her back and a couple hundred bucks in cash that she had squirreled away, and she had bought a ticket a week prior, so we know that she had been thinking about leaving for at least a week, and that ticket was going to expire that day, so she, I guess, felt like she had to use it or lose it.
Jennifer would later state that she was so stressed about the wedding that she contemplated committing suicide.
She had a bottle of pills and she had a bus ticket, and it was a life or death situation, and she basically chose life, but the escape of going the route of the bus ticket instead of the escape of death, I suppose.
She took a bus ticket and she got out of town.
I mean, it was either this or take a bottle of pills. It was life or death. I couldn't stay. Cut my hair at the office park.
She cut her hair in order to disguise her appearance. She made some attempt to make it hard to identify her. So she did have some planning that maybe folks would be looking for her.
She planned that getaway almost as well as she had planned the wedding. I mean, she had bought her ticket in advance using a fake name.
Traveling with only $140 in cash, she takes a taxi from Duluth to the Atlanta bus depot.
Something snapped, and she got on a bus, and that was that.
Over the next 3 days, Jennifer takes a bus ride across the country.
Jennifer later told Katie Couric that her first destination was actually Austin, Texas. Why? Because she'd seen a documentary about the city that starred Matthew McConaughey. Jennifer never made it to Austin, Texas. She switched buses in Dallas. She went from there to Las Vegas, and then she ultimately ended up in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
She lived off of candy bars and McDonald's and just cheap food. She was trying to make the money last as long as possible.
Met that nice couple some way along the drive.
Along the way, Jennifer's fellow travelers provide the inspiration for her fictitious kidnappers.
You okay, darling? Something sweet will make it better.
Jennifer had modeled these fictional characters in her kidnapping story after two random and innocent people that she'd seen on the bus.
Those people were top of mind because they were actual people that she had met. And so she was just kind of like, yeah, they were these two people. They were real people, but they didn't abduct her.
You're doing good.
Then we got to Albuquerque and I don't know, it's just kind of a blur. Until I got to that payphone at the gas station and called John.
At that point, it seemed like she had run out of money, didn't know where she was, and just decided to make a call from a payphone.
Hello?
John!
Danny, where are you?
I don't know.
Had no idea that the national media and everybody and their mom was out looking for her. Had no idea because she was on a bus this whole time.
What's going to happen to me?
Don't be concerned about that right now. Just one step at a time. But thank you for the information, okay? We're going to get you home soon.
Okay.
Thank you. Trisha's going to take care of you.
Jennifer claims to be unaware that she's been front page news while on her cross-country bus ride.
I told her, people are looking for you and this is national news now.
Thought you might be cold.
What's all the noise?
It's the media. There's got to be at least 30 news cameras out there. This has become a really big deal.
And of course, by then, you know, now I was aware that this was a total false accusation, and then I remember thinking, boy, it's really going to be a bigger deal even now, because now she had made up all this information and now she had lied about it.
Early Saturday morning in Georgia, Jennifer's fiancé, John Mason, is still unaware that her story is fake. He and family members celebrate the announcement of her safe recovery. And the media broadcasts news that she's been found.
We didn't quite know what happened to her or where she was. We just knew that she made this phone call from a payphone in Albuquerque saying that she was okay. And so we were excited about it. It was breaking news. It was rolling coverage. The first part of the morning, it was jubilee. It was celebration. She's alive. She's okay. People have heard her voice. And we were just ecstatic.
But in a matter of hours, joyful celebration turns to subdued shock when Albuquerque police hold a press conference and the truth comes out.
And it was really at that time that she decided to tell the truth about the entire incident.
It was just sort of a sinking feeling finding out that, wow, she made it up.
Our newsroom just went berserk, thinking she faked her disappearance.
It became a headline because of a wedding. She ruined her entire wedding, and she ruined her entire family, and she ruined her entire image of what people thought of her.
Albuquerque officer Trish Hoffman reads a brief prepared statement from Jennifer.
I appreciate the outpouring of prayers and concern, and that she has recently become aware of.
When it came out that this whole story had been made up, the media went nuts. And she got all these names, like the runaway bride and the fiancé.
The first moment of public reckoning comes at the Albuquerque airport as Jennifer is escorted by local police.
Ladies and gentlemen, give us...
It is a media spectacle.
She put a blanket on top of her head. For what reason, I'm not really sure. Obviously, to get her face covered or didn't want to be seen and the cameras. And so she wasn't able to see, which is why she had grabbed onto my arm.
The infamous photo with the towel over her head is etched in everybody's memory because we thought, who does this? Like, you need to take this walk of shame because of what you did.
Jennifer, is there anything you want to say before you get on the plane?
It's supposed to be her wedding day. But instead of walking down the aisle with a veil, she's walking through the airport with a blanket over her head.
Trish Hoffman makes sure Jennifer is safely in her first-class seat on the plane. Also on board are numerous members of the media.
People Magazine was on the plane, CNN, all different media staff were buying the tickets to fly on the plane with her.
Shortly before the plane touched down in Atlanta, a flight attendant handed the media a written statement from the family. It says that Jennifer has spoken to her fiancé, that he's looking forward to seeing her again, and that the wedding hasn't been canceled, just postponed.
Everybody wanted to know, are they going to stay together? Was he going to take her back? Is he going to marry this woman? And so that kind of became the next guessing game.
Back home in Georgia, Jennifer immediately goes into seclusion at her mother's home, where she reunites with fiancé John Mason.
She hid out in her parents' basement and she talked with John, and he gave her the ring back, and they said that they still intended to get married, but he wanted her to, you know, work on whatever, you know, her issues were.
When he said he still loved her and wanted to marry her, we were like, okay, maybe they both need some help here.
Shortly afterwards, Jennifer voluntarily enters a mental health facility for treatment.
In a statement released by her pastor, Jennifer said that she was receiving professional treatment, but that she couldn't fully explain why she ran away, other than the fact that she was running away from herself and also certain fears that she had.
He basically read her statement, and yeah, that was fine, but everybody wanted to know from her mouth. But it seems like the gist of the statement was, a lot of things were happening, I was under a lot of stress, emotionally, physically, and that's how she justified running away.
Meanwhile, controversy was brewing over the money that was spent in her search, and many people in the community were outraged. And a funny thing happened to the missing signs that were put up for Jennifer. Over her face was this banner that said, "Case closed, cold feet."
There was a lot of expense involved in this and a lot of effort put forth. And any time you have an operation this large, it's going to cost quite a bit. And a lot of the taxpayers weren't too happy about their tax money being spent for this or wasted, as they thought.
I think they ultimately tallied it up to be around $60,000 that the city spent on overtime and costs or feeding all the people that were out there trying to find her over those 3 days.
In the end, she only paid back a fraction of that.
Jennifer also faces backlash for the racially toned description of her fake assailants.
What really was troubling was that she mentioned that she said she had been sexually assaulted. And the worst part about it is that she blamed an Hispanic man.
To bring race and a Hispanic person who didn't apparently exist into it, that drew a lot of criticism.
Until she comes out and apologizes to our community, we're not going to let go.
Local authorities later charged Jennifer with making false statements to police.
Your Honor, I'm truly sorry for my actions.
She pleads no contest to a felony charge and receives 2 years probation. The judge also orders Jennifer to continue mental health treatment and complete 120 hours of community service.
That was even a spectacle. There was all these cameras out on the side of the road filming her mowing the lawn, and it was like, to me, just looked like such a humiliating exercise, you know, to have to be parading around in front of reporters on a hot day mowing the lawn in a jumpsuit.
While some sympathize with Jennifer, others seek to cash in on her notoriety.
Jennifer's story branded her as the runaway bride.
There was stuff on eBay for sale, like original copies of the flyer for sale.
There was Jennifer's Hightailin' hot sauce. There was even an action figure made of her.
And yeah, bobbleheads. A bobblehead Jennifer Wilbanks.
Someone offered me $10,000 for that blanket. And, you know, I joked at the time and I thought, oh my gosh, if that blanket was worth $10,000, I should have thought and put like my police jacket on top of her head.
The case of the runaway bride goes on to inspire an Albuquerque police recruitment campaign.
We did a recruiting campaign, and the whole highlight of the campaign was, if you're running away from your career, call APD. I put a veil on and in my uniform, and it got so much attention. We got a ton of response from out-of-state people. People saw it in New York. I mean, it was all over. We did get a lot of interest in the police department because of that.
Jennifer and John cash in by signing a $500,000 book deal to tell all about their story.
A book is never published. And in May 2006, it's reported the Jennifer and John split, ending months of speculation about the couple's long-term fate.
This is the first time that things get truly ugly.
In September 2006, Jennifer Wilbanks sues John Mason for $500,000, claiming John misused her finances from the book deal.
Not only does Jennifer sue John, but she allegedly tells him that she wants to keep all the wedding shower gifts. Who does that?
John countersues, claiming emotional pain from being essentially left at the altar. But in December, both parties dropped their lawsuits. In 2008, John Mason finally does get married to another woman. However, they divorce in 2012.
This goes to show you, you don't know people. You know, you need to date a while. You need to court a while. You need to ask some questions. You need to see if there's some red flags.
Jennifer Wilbanks declares bankruptcy in 2010. She reportedly still lives in Georgia.
I think the community has completely forgiven Jennifer. I think what she went through was worse for her than just about anybody to have to come home and face the music like that.
I don't think we still know exactly why she would have done this. Why does a woman who has a fiancé who loves her, a family of some sort of means, somebody who by all accounts had been planning this gorgeous wedding for a long time, why would she walk away from it all?
You don't know what other people go through, but I think that she was obviously not thinking clearly when she did what she did.
This one certainly ended up in a way that was unexpected. But it came to a good end. She was alive, and she's still alive today. So that's the best thing that could have come out of it.
In the big picture, who did it really hurt? It hurt her and her family.
At the time, I just remember thinking she must be a horrible person. And now I look at her with more sympathy because I know she didn't mean to bring any of that on anyone.
I hope that she's in a better place than she was back then.